It's Thanksgiving Day, 1966. At 4 a.m., it's still dark with a chill in the air. Two private train cars stop at an abandoned depot 4 miles north of Las Vegas. It's an isolated, barren stretch. A small cargo van waits by the tracks, its engine running. At the wheel is Chicago mobster Johnny Rosselli, known as Handsome Johnny. He's a fit, affable guy who favors tasteful suits. His associate, Joe Breen, rides shotgun. Breen surveys the scene and shakes his head. Christ, Johnny, I can't believe this is how the guy comes to Vegas. He's a freaking multi-billionaire. It's just weird.
You think this is weird?
You ain't seen nothing yet. Rosselli flashes his headlights 3 times at the train. 2 men slowly emerge, carrying a stretcher. Sprawled on top of it is the emaciated billionaire in question, Howard Hughes. Hughes is 61 and a shadow of his former self. In the 1920s, he was a handsome, maverick aviator. He owned a film studio. He was a powerful, shrewd industrialist. He enjoyed ticker tape parades and was a fixture of gossip columns, usually for dating a legion of stunning starlets. And Hughes' mob ties go way back. Rosselli's known him since the early 30s. The ultimate fixer, Rosselli's the man you call for certain delicate jobs. He's worked with everyone from the mob to the CIA. Now, he's working for Howard Hughes, who has a dream of turning Vegas into his own urban showplace. It'll be his personal, thriving metropolis, complete with a high-speed rail system. Rosselli plucks a well-chewed toothpick from his mouth and gestures at the stretcher.
Remember that plane crash he had in 46? Flew the thing into a house in Beverly Hills. He ain't been the same since.
Hughes barely survived the wreck of a prototype spy plane, emerging with chronic pain that left him addicted to narcotics. He suffered a mental breakdown a few years later and has been living in complete seclusion. In and out of dementia, Hughes is obsessed with germs and his bodily functions, and he never bathes or cuts his hair or fingernails. Rosselli glances at Breen.
Let's go say hello.
The men climb out of the truck as the stretcher approaches. Rosselli opens the back doors. As they load Hughes in, Rosselli leans close, holding his breath against the overpowering odor of soiled, unwashed flesh.
Hello, Howard. It's been a while.
Hughes's hair is long, greasy, and stringy. He tries to focus on Rosselli.
Oh, hello, Johnny. Say, when are we going to go play some golf?
Rosselli smiles down at Hughes. It's a ridiculous notion.
Real soon, Howard. But first, I'm going to get you set up at the Desert Inn. Got you the 2 top floors all to yourself. Had them cover up all the windows the way you like it, nice and dark.
Hughes manages a weak grin. Rosselli and Breen get back in the van. Rosselli drives his precious cargo into the rising sun toward the Desert Inn on the Strip. It's hardly been 2 weeks since Paul Laxalt was elected governor of Nevada, a cause Hughes was instrumental in bankrolling. The relationship favors both men. Laxalt wants to consolidate his place in politics, and if he succeeds, it will pave the way for Hughes to launch a financial blitzkrieg to take over Las Vegas.
If you travel for work, you know to pack 2 suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/youknowbusiness.
Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's vice chair and president, Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though many of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill talk about how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can check out this episode and a whole lot more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts.
From Wondery, I'm David Brown, and this is Business Wars.
In our last episode, former Governor Grant Sawyer went after mob rule of the Vegas gambling business with a vengeance. He laid down strict rules and regulations for gaming and issued the notorious Black Book, a compendium of mobsters forbidden to own or even set foot in a Nevada casino. But Sawyer made enemies from the local underworld to Washington. He rebuffed efforts by J. Edgar Hoover's FBI and Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy to help him rid the casinos of the mob. Now, Howard Hughes is hell-bent on buying Sin City, and he has new Governor Paul Laxalt firmly in his corner. But Hughes isn't the only wealthy entrepreneur with designs on taking over the town. In fact, he's got a challenger set on building the biggest hotel on the planet. And that contender doesn't need political favors or mob connections. The chronic war for Las Vegas is long past its seedy beginnings. Now, it's headed toward an entirely new and brutal front, with larger-than-life personalities intent on making this city their own personal piggy bank. This is Episode 4 of The Birth of Vegas, Casino Combat. It's January of 1967 in Carson City at the governor's mansion. Paul Laxalt is debriefing his top staffers. He's just returned from Washington, D.C., where he had a private discussion with J. Edgar Hoover at FBI headquarters. Laxalt looks around the table through the cigarette smoke.
Hoover has a mountain of evidence on mob control of the Vegas casino business. I know. He showed it to me.
The new governor was shocked at what Hoover had gathered. Whether it was gained illegally or not was beside the point. Laxalt continues.
The town's getting a very bad rap in the press with the feds coming down on organized crime. I know Hoover's leaking stories, but like I've said before, we need to work with him. Right, Paul, and the mob knows it's under scrutiny. Let the man investigate all he wants. I don't want him as an enemy.
I agree. I've heard talk that the feds are thinking of closing down casinos. Governor, that would be catastrophic. Construction and development are already slowing down. What can we do on our end to clean the town up?
That's where Howard Hughes comes in. He's an oddball, I'll give you that, but he's an obscenely rich oddball, and he wants to invest in Vegas. The more we can help him do that, the better.
The public loves a guy, and he's not connected to the mob. If he starts buying casinos, he could be the face of the new Vegas.
Exactly. At the very least, he could push the mob back into the shadows. And if word gets out that the money in Vegas is no longer controlled by the mob, it could draw new investors.
As 1967 kicks in, Hughes is holed up in the Desert Inn, never leaving the two top floors of the hotel. He communicates entirely through his right-hand man, Robert Mayhew, a lawyer and former FBI and CIA agent. Mayhew has handled all of Hughes' concerns since 1955. He is Hughes' most trusted operative. But Mayhew has never actually seen Hughes in the flesh.
Paranoid about almost everything, Hughes communicates exclusively by phone and frantic notes scribbled in a narcotic haze. After almost 2 months at the Desert Inn, Mo DeLitz has had enough of Howard Hughes. DeLitz is a tough, aging Cleveland racketeer, and he owns the hotel. He places a call to Mayhew.
Hello?
It's DeLitz. Listen, Mayhew, I need Hughes out of my hotel. He's taken up two whole floors, and he doesn't even gamble. None of his people spent a cent in my casino.
Mayhew has installed dozens of underlings at the Desert Inn to take care of Hughes's needs. They're all young Mormon men, and Mormons don't gamble. But like the Mafia, Mayhew thinks Mormons make excellent employees. They're loyal, trustworthy, and keep their mouths shut.
Look, Mo, Mr. Hughes is not going to like this.
I don't give a damn. I got those rooms reserved for high rollers coming in. You get him out, or I will.
Mayhew stares at the phone for a minute. Then, he calls his boss. After 27 rings, Hughes picks up.
What is it?
Sorry to bother you, Howard, but they want you out of the hotel. They have the rooms booked
and... You can tell them I'm not leaving.
I'm afraid they mean business. In fact...
You can tell them I'll buy the place.
In early 1967, Mayhew cuts a deal with DeLitz for the Desert Inn Hotel and Casino. Hughes pays $6.2 million in cash and also pays off a $7 million Teamster loan to Union President Jimmy Hoffa. The cost is a pittance for Hughes. Everyone's happy. The top floors are his base of operations. The windows remain blacked out permanently. Entry is strictly forbidden to anyone but trusted Mormon staffers who are on 8-hour shifts around the clock. But to keep the Desert Inn's casino doors open, Hughes needs a gaming license. In his lucid moments, he's well aware of that and he orders Mayhew to make it happen. But Hughes's paranoia and state of mind present a challenge. The feds carefully scrutinize who qualifies for a license, and Hughes refuses to be fingerprinted or photographed. He won't leave his rooms to sign anything, and he won't allow anyone in to witness a signature. Mayhew calls in a favor from Paul Laxalt, the new Nevada governor Hughes helped install. Laxalt is happy to lend a hand. Hughes's hotel purchase, buying out a known mobster like Mo DeLitz, is exactly what Laxalt was hoping would happen. And he wants Hughes to continue shopping. It'll keep the feds at bay and give Vegas a veneer of respectability. Laxalt hooks Mayhew up with a local lawyer, Thomas Bell. Bell is a seasoned legal gunslinger with connections. He recommends Hughes make an annual donation of $300,000 for a 20-year period to the University of Nevada's medical school. And Hughes does it. Days later, the Gaming Control Board greenlights Hughes' license. It'll be held by the Hughes Tool Company, an industrial megacorporation, and the foundation of his riches. It's owned 100% by Hughes. Mayhew calls Johnny Rosselli, the ultimate fixer in Vegas. Rosselli, now an employee of Hughes, rehires Mo DeLitz, the former owner of the Desert Inn, as a consultant. DeLitz rehires his people. It's back to business as usual. Mobsters are running the hotel once again, but with a big difference, because Howard Hughes is the front man. But Hughes is not the only power player rising in Las Vegas. It's the summer of 1967. Kirk Kerkorian is driving his friend Las Vegas Sun publisher Hank Greenspun toward the edge of town. Kerkorian pulls over on Paradise Road, but it might as well be on Mars. From inside the car, they've got a clear view of the strip a half mile away.
Take a good look, Hank. What do you think? As the dashboard AC blasts his face, Greenspun blinks into the 101-degree sunshine. He sees the Las Vegas Convention Center, the hulking, uncompleted Landmark Hotel standing skeletal and dormant, and some 65 acres of desert scrub that was once a horse track.
What am I supposed to be looking at, Kirk?
The site of the biggest hotel on the planet. For the last 5 years, Kerkorian has been leveraging a fortune he made in aviation, working his way up in Vegas development. Among other quiet deals, he owns and leases the land that the lavish $25 million Caesar's Palace was built on. But his ambitions are much, much bigger. He wants to enter the hospitality game himself, and he has the means to dominate it. Kerkorian knows all about the mob, but he's not connected, and he doesn't need or want to be. He's a hard-working entrepreneur who keeps his nose clean and stays out of the spotlight. The place is going to have 1,500 rooms and the state's largest casino. Greenspun is stunned.
1,500 rooms?
Caesar's has 700, and it's huge. But I gotta say, a hotel like that next to the convention center, well, it makes damn good sense.
Kerkorian gazes at the desolate acreage and smiles.
It's gonna change everything. There's nothing like it in Vegas.
Kerkorian is right. His opulent international hotel will cost $30 million and help usher in a new era of mega hotels in Vegas. And it will righteously piss off Howard Hughes, the one man in Vegas who can go up against Kerkorian. Unlike Kerkorian, Hughes is a man whose vast wealth is matched only by his colossal ego. Hughes has tremendous respect for Kerkorian, but doesn't want to be one-upped by him. So he offers to purchase the land from Kerkorian, but Kerkorian passes. Then Hughes offers to trade Kerkorian a hotel for the property. Kerkorian passes again. Finally, Hughes suggests they go into business together. Kerkorian isn't interested. Meanwhile, through his minions Mayhew and Rosselli, Hughes has been buying hotels like crazy. By the end of 1967, he's added 6 properties to his portfolio. Licenses for all of them have been granted to Hughes, yet no one has actually seen him. It's beyond unorthodox. In January of 1968, Hughes announces a $150 million renovation of the latest addition to his stable, the Sands Hotel. It'll top the splendor of the upcoming International, and it's a direct shot at his arch rival. In October of 1968, in a final stab at besting Kerkorian, Hughes shells out $20 million for the property across the road from the quickly rising International Hotel. On that property is the half-built, dilapidated Landmark Hotel, which has been sitting empty for almost a decade. It stands, barely, as a landmark of bankruptcy and disaster. Hughes plans to bring the place back to life in a bid to go head-to-head with Kerkorian. It will be a casino combat on a grand scale. Meanwhile, Mayhew tells the press that Hughes is trying to make Las Vegas as respectable and trustworthy as the New York Stock Exchange. The legitimate Vegas business establishment and the Nevada political world loves Hughes. He's the single biggest developer in Nevada history, and his reassuring presence draws in other investors previously afraid of taking on the mob. Laxalt is thrilled with Hughes' rampant investments. The billionaire is treating him like a king. He's even offered to back Laxalt in a presidential run. But Laxalt is growing concerned. Is all of this benevolence really coming from Howard Hughes? Is Hughes even alive? Laxalt has no way to know.
he's never laid eyes on the man. What if he's being played for some unknown reason? If he is being set up, his deferential treatment of Hughes could be political suicide.
If Laxalt is going to forestall a potential scandal, he has to connect with Howard Hughes, the man who refuses to connect with anyone.
You know, Audible has a brand new collection of exclusive thrillers. Every move is made more exciting by captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. I just downloaded The Grand Opening by Carl Weber. It's a mystery about a family business in a small southern town, and there are secrets around every turn. You know, when I'm listening, the time just disappears, getting completely immersed in the story and the performances. And as an Audible member, you get to keep one title a month from their entire catalog, including bestsellers and new releases. So come on, listen along. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Head on over to audible.com/BW or just text BW to 500-500. That's audible.com/BW or text BW to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. We get support from Acura. The spirit of performance is what defines Acura. And now, it's electric. Introducing the ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
It's late 1967 at the Las Vegas Country Club. Governor Paul Laxalt and Robert Mayhew are playing tennis, but Laxalt can't concentrate.
Nice backhand, Bob, but, hey, I need to ask you something.
Of course, Paul. What's up?
I need to meet with Hughes.
Mayhew is taken aback. Even he's never met with Hughes. But he can tell the governor is serious.
Is something wrong?
No, Bob, it's... Look, it's just that... Well, we've been issuing him casino licenses and the State Gaming Commission has never laid eyes on the guy. I just need assurance that everything is good.
Of course, I understand. Let me see what I can do.
Laxalt knows he's on dangerous ground. If Hughes takes offense to the demand, who knows how he might react? He spent over $125 million on Nevada real estate and shows no sign of stopping. But there's talk that property isn't the only thing that Hughes is buying. There are whispers that Laxalt's loyalty is one of his acquisitions, too. And Laxalt wants to kill that idea.
The bottom line is there's a lot of power in Hughes' lab, and if he decides to cut ties with Vegas and move on, the impact on the economy and Laxalt's career could be devastating.
Mayhew tells Laxalt that an in-person meeting with Hughes is unlikely, but late on a December night in the governor's mansion, an alternative arrives. Laxalt wakes from a deep sleep and fumbles for the phone.
Hello?
Laxalt, it's Howard Hughes.
Uh-huh. Yes, thanks for calling, Mr. Hughes. I know how much you value your privacy.
I'm glad you understand that, Laxalt. You're a good man.
Thanks, Mr. Hughes. I just wanted to... Well, I wanted to check in with you. I appreciate your time. And I'd like to meet in person someday.
I'd like to meet you someday too, Governor. But frankly, right now I look like a goddamn cadaver.
The conversation is brief. When they hang up, Laxalt feels relieved. He's finally spoken to Howard Hughes. At least, he lets himself believe he has.
With his confidence in Hughes restored,
Laxalt focuses on weakening the mob's influence by pushing changes that will open up casino ownership to corporate investors. On July 1, 1969, Hughes Landmark Hotel has its grand opening. The date is crucial for Hughes. It's one day before Kerkorian's grand opening for the International Hotel. The Landmark party is adequate at best. The VIP guest list of 480 includes Laxalt and various aging Hollywood celebrities. Hughes is nowhere to be seen. The event pales in comparison to Kerkorian's black tie opening the following night. The $60 million International is stunning and boasts Barbara Streisand as the headlining act. Kerkorian is there in a tuxedo, keeping his usual low profile. The International is an unparalleled success. The casino rakes it in, and rooms are sold out. In July, Kerkorian scores an even bigger triumph. Elvis Presley stages his legendary live comeback at the International, breaking box office records. His residency remains a popular Vegas attraction for the next 5 years. Across the street, Hughes's Landmark Hotel loses $5 million in its first week. By 1970, all of Hughes's casinos are losing millions. None of this escapes the feds. The IRS estimates some $50 million has been siphoned from his businesses. It's an inside job. Mobsters view Hughes's inexperienced corporate infrastructure as an easy mark and are taking advantage of the opportunity. What happens next is a bit murky. Mayhew is implicated in the massive fraud and allegedly fired by Hughes. Laxalt is in the dark about what exactly is going on. And the Nixon White House is looking into possible kickbacks. One thing is certain. 4 years to the day after Hughes arrived in Las Vegas by stretcher, he leaves the same way. On Thanksgiving night, he's bundled out of the Desert Inn through a fire exit into an unmarked van and delivered to Nellis Air Force Base. It's the first time Hughes has left the ninth floor of the hotel since he arrived. Control of his Vegas kingdom goes into protracted corporate litigation. His casinos are sold off. Hughes' bizarre Vegas run is over. Kerkorian wins. He's the new king. As legitimate, respected investors, Hughes and Kerkorian had a huge impact on the city's economic future. With Laxalt's help, they have birthed the next chapter, corporate Vegas. And that means the stakes in this battle just got higher. In our next episode, the feds are pressing down harder than ever. Big business is raining money down on the strip. The mob needs to chart a desperate course for survival in the money-making empire they created. Hey, Prime members, you can binge every episode of Business Wars ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. From Wondery, this is episode 4 of The Birth of Vegas for Business Wars. A quick note about recreations you've been hearing. In most cases, we can't know exactly what was said at the time. Those scenes are dramatizations, but they are based on historical research. And we use many sources when researching our stories, but we especially recommend The Money and the Power by Sally Denton and Roger Morris, The Gambler by William C. Rempel, Handsome Johnny by Lee Server, The Battle for Las Vegas by Dennis N. Griffin, and Las Vegas, An Unconventional History by Michelle Ferrari and Stephen Ives. I'm your host, David Brown. Peter Gilstrap wrote this story. Karen Lowe is our senior producer and editor, edited and produced by Emily Frost. Sound design by Kyle Randall. Our associate producer is Kate Young. Our producer is Dave Schilling. Our executive producers are Jenny Lauer Beckman and Marshall Louie. Created by Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.